Hello and welcome to the Random Walks podcast. Today I have Dr. Christopher Rokakis, who is an applied mathematics instructor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, as well as the director of modeling and simulation at Julia Computing and the lead creator and developer of Julia Sim. Chris is also the director of scientific research at Puma's AI and creator and lead developer of Puma's, as well as the lead developer of the SkyML open source software organization. Chris's research and software is focused on scientific machine learning, especially in the integration of domain models with artificial intelligence techniques like machine learning by utilizing the structured scientific models together with unstructured data-driven problems of machine learning. He seeks to accelerate simulations as well as better help science approximate the true systems while enjoying the robustness and explainability of mechanistic dynamic models. Chris received his master's and PhD at the University of California, Irvine, where he was awarded the Mathematical and Computational Biology Institution Fellowship, alongside many other prestigious fellowships, and he was also an undergraduate student at Oberlin College. Welcome, Chris.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction.
So Chris, you have had a really stellar journey through both science and life, and you have been sort of actively at the forefront of research and what has been a very bubbling and happening field over the past decade and all. So where did this all start for you? As a young child, were you always seeking out to sort of explore this whole interface of computing, mathematics and sciences and all? Was research something on your mind as growing up as a kid, or were there any inspirations, familial or in your school life, who sort of kickstarted you in this terrific career path?
Yeah, actually, that's a real good question. I mean, I kind of knew that I was like a kind of a math guy in a weird way since I was really young. In fact, I guess when I was in first grade, I actually said that I'm either going to become a math professor or a pilot. So I think that math professor won there, but I mean, I did change my mind multiple times. So when I was in fifth grade, I think I remember doing like, it is actually written in the yearbook. It's like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? And then I wrote down cryptozoologist, right? But that already tells you, like, you know, there's a science bent there, like, because if you even know what cryptozoology is, like, there's something going on with this kid, right? So then, you know, I kind of actually went through a very chill phase, I would say. So I grew up in Southern California, and my parents were very, you know, I would say that they're kind of hippies. My dad was a guitar player, met my mom and everything. So they had this very like laid back, like, you know, when you're growing up, don't overdo it kind of lifestyle. So I ended up being like a three sport athlete, you know, doing Model United Nations and like all these things that are very non-math focused for a very long time, just to kind of, I mean, I feel like it rounded out my character a lot. When I really got into undergrad, I started doing, I was building my own major actually, which was, it was called theory of modeling, right? So a lot of it, I really wanted to do philosophy of science and stuff like that. And what I really started to dig into was what are the mathematical methods that we're using to try to understand science, right? I got really into like, you know, I'm going to take like, you know how there's like the 200 level course in every single discipline, like, you know, methods in psychology, methods in economics, like methods here, methods there, right? So that's what I really built my undergrad around, which is a really weird undergrad to do, right? Because it's like, you know, the one course that nobody wants to do in their major, right, is the one course that I chose to do in every single other person's major, right? But it was just like, you know, that's, so then I learned like, you know, time series analysis and how it's done in econometrics, and then, you know, how is statistical analysis done in psychology, and then, you know, how, yeah, but then that really brought me like, okay, I guess I need to learn a lot more math, right? So I it was like a math major with this, you know, kind of other do your own major, because I was at a liberal arts school and that's what people do, right? And I finally went on to do a PhD in mathematics. And then, you know, that was tied to a mathematical biology program that I went into, mostly because I hadn't done biology before, right? So I had done, you know, through that I did like the math courses in physics and, you know, math and computer science, math and psychology, math and economics. And I got into all the schools I wanted to, right? So like University of Minnesota, and I talked with like you know, Guggenheimer at Cornell and things. But when I went home to Southern California, I stopped by UC Irvine, just had me like, oh yeah, this is one of the schools I was looking at. And I talked with the whole math bio group, and what they were all working on, I thought was just really cool. It was like, I knew that was what I wanted to work on. So, you know, I ended up going to do my PhD about 30 minutes away from where I grew up. And that just was perfect, right? Because it was all about this, it's kind of this same thread where it's like, you know, what started bringing me into math was really this question of like, how do you know that your models are meaningful or real or, and systems biology is definitely like a place that really asks that question all the time, because you know that your model is incorrect in systems biology, right? You know from the start that there's, you know, what proteins cause this disease? Well, there's hundreds of thousands of proteins, but you know, like, but you really want to kind of say like, okay, but can we make a story out of 10 of them that is predictive, right? And so then I really started digging into this question of how does the randomness in the biology actually do something to, you know, because there's always diffusion, and so everything should be essentially random. But how do you make it so that way? You know, your two arms are built from different signals, right? They're built from a retinoic acid signal that comes from your shoulder downwards, right? And so you have this random gradient. It's like you put a drop of dye in there, right? And there's a random gradient that is able to read how far away it is from where that drop of dye it starts from. But both of your arms end up very, very similar in size. So how does that randomness kind of get filtered out? And that's where, like, you know, my high school world of like being like, you know, I'm just into music and you know, music and sports and everything, right? That whole world, I was actually doing a lot of audio engineering there and looking into how do you filter noise to be able to change how you're you know, I was like, you know, working with distortion pedals and just kind of playing around with all those things. That same kind of world of mathematics was then kind of brought into a lot of us doing my PhD. And so I got really into like the computational aspects, which then brought me to do numerical differential equations. And then, you know, the story really took off when I started writing the Julia differential equation solvers. So, I mean, Random Walks podcast, I think I'm on the right spot.
Absolutely. That was a really stunning overview and a really terrific overview of the wonderful journey you have sort of traversed over the last decade and so, and right at the interface of something that has been absolutely booming and all. And you have been sort of right from being inspired to do cryptozoology as a child to sort of like coming all the way to sort of traversing and donning the hats of a mathematician, software engineer, and a pharmacologist. You've really come a long way in your random walks and all. And something.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's a far place, right? But like cryptozoology is the same question. It's like, how do you know that the story about Bigfoot is false? You know, if you just like hear something on TV when you're in fourth grade or something, like what is the information that will tip you off that this is a fake story, right? It's all this philosophy of science kind of going all the way through in a very, you know, philosophy of science then kind of brings into this analytical realm where you start having to ask questions about how do models work. And I just really love that whole world. Yeah,
absolutely. And as a mathematician, something that I'm inclined to ask you, that is usually the very first question that we pose to mathematicians who come on Random Walks, and that is, how would you define mathematics?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. So I would define mathematics as a structured way of thinking that gives you definite that is all about trying to figure out what do you actually believe given the assumptions that you're taking, right? And actually philosophy is the same way, right? I do not think that philosophy and math are that different. Basically, like the idea is you're basically saying like, if I believe X and Y, the whole point of math is just to prove that, well, then you actually also believe that Z happens, right? You know, like if you believe that the real numbers are these things which have all these decimal expansions, right? Then you can, you know, write out the decimal expansions and build a real number that's not in your list, and you know, the diagonalization experiment. So therefore, this infinity is larger than another infinity, right? Like you're basically saying that if you believe these things, then you believe these things, and you know, so it's more about the conditionals of the world, right? So so it doesn't tell you it doesn't tell you what you should be thinking, right? You know, everyone feels like math is like this definite thing, and no, the math doesn't tell you what you should be thinking. math tells you, if you were to, you know, it tells you what conditionals you have to take as true, right? The what if statements are true. And so, you know, so then you kind of build a world of like, okay, you know, this world has its own canopy of, you know, if I take these assumptions and this is true, then this and this and this and this and this. If I take this canopy, then there's this whole tree of assumptions going on, right? And it really starts to come into play when you, you know, start looking at, you know, like a lot of things are quite figured out in simpler areas of math, right? You know, when you look at calculus, you don't really see the whole statement of if statements because you're always like, well, you know, you're like, oh, you know, the derivative is defined by this. And that's not actually true though, right? If you when you get into real analysis courses, you find out that like, oh, if you have, you know, these conditions true, so like you have a, you know, if you have certain, you know, if you have absolute continuity, et cetera, then the fundamental theorem of calculus holds, right? But you know, you kind of, so as you dig deeper and deeper into it, I feel like you kind of see like there's this whole world of like trying to just kind of figure out how to go from your simpler beliefs to more complex beliefs in a way that really tells you what your complex beliefs necessarily need to be.
That was a really interesting definition of mathematics, that mathematics, and a really great overview of the way mathematics has come along. And over the last century of sorts, there has been, especially in the last half a century, there has been a lot of sort of revolution at the interface of maths and computing, and something that was evidenced by this year's one of the highest honors in maths, the Abel Prize, going to two phenomenal theoretical computer scientists, Avi Vigdorson and Laszlo Lovaas. And it really comes to showcase how maths and computing have really come a long way, especially in this age of big data and all, where it is sort of what's fundamentally powering these advances.
Yeah, I mean, like, so, you know, computing is definitely one major thing that has come out of math, and it's basically taken a life of its own. And it, you know, especially in numerical computing, right? So the area that I work in is like numerical differential equations and like this kind of low level that people, you know, people generally say like, you know, oh, never write your own, you know, it's ODE solver, always call ODE 4 or 5 because, you know, this robot, you know, and so there's someone, you know, there's the Wizard of Oz, right? You know, there's someone behind the curtain who actually had to write that in the first place, right? And that's the kind of thing that I do a lot of my time with, right? And it's just like, you know, it's a really nice world where, you know, where like you can mathematically talk about these algorithms all the time, right? You know, like, so differential equations I always will come back to because everything in the world is a differential equation, right? And actually that's true, right? Because, you know, you're always measuring how things change when you do science, right? And so what relations that you know in science are always how things change. And so if you write down an equation of how things change, you have a differential equation, right? But, you know, when you're really looking at like, you know, the mathematics of differential equations and such, right? You know, it's once again, it's all these conditional statements, right? It's like, oh, you know, if you have, you know, 5 derivatives defined, then this Runge-Kutta method will converge at fifth order, you know, or actually you need 6 derivatives defined, right? Yeah, it's like this whole thing of like, oh, if these things are true, then this is a method that converges at this rate. And if these things are true, then these converge at this rate. But then you kind of have to look at the world and say, well, you know, which of these things are true in the world, and when do these methods actually matter, right? And that's what I find really, really fascinating in computing, right? Because when you really get down to the computing and the applications, then you learn new things about the world, right? Because, you know, there's some of these things about how, you know, well, is a ninth order ODE integrator or better? Like, you know, nothing about the mathematics can answer that question, because better really means something about what you're modeling, right? But when you put it into a computer and then you start to like see, you know, what happens when you optimize these codes a lot, then you start to see things like, oh, you know, a ninth order ODE integrator is better ninth order ODE integrator is better in this case, but it's not as good in this case. And you start to then understand how it really then connects to the way that you know, that people are using math and the way that people are using science. Like, you know, I really actually find that that aspect fascinating, because, you know, so let me kind of like dig a little into that, right? So when you talk about like ODE solvers and you do all these proofs, right? Like what you do mathematically is you prove things like as delta t goes to zero, then you have this, you know, this rate of at which you go to zero, right? And so, you know, mathematically, you know, going to having your error go to zero at a higher power is, you know, going to having your error go to zero faster always seems to make sense, right? But then when you go to computing, right, the purpose of computing with differential equations is you want to be able to simulate something, right? And to simulate something, you want to be able to take as big time steps as possible with as little error. And so, you know, your mathematics is, well, here's how everything works as delta t goes to zero. And your reality is make delta t as big as possible, right? And so, you know, then really trying to understand then how, you know, how does mathematics relate to the real world? You know, this is a very interesting case where you kind of have to get, you know, you use what you can feel about the mathematics as a guide for how you do the computing. And then it gives you like some, you know, it grounds you more than a bit more than like, you know, statistics and psychology, where sometimes it can be really hard to find grounding. Like you, in this case, you know the answer, right? You can like plug these things in and see that, you know, this algorithm is faster here than this one. But then you really have to ask the question, why? Like, you know, why is this one doing better? Our mathematical analysis is not about the situation. So what is it heuristically that makes sense? And so for example, with high order Runge Kutta integrators, right? The thing is that as you go further down a Taylor series, the coefficients they get smaller and smaller by the factorial of the last coefficient, right? But you know, So you want to go far enough down to be able to get a small enough coefficient of your error. But if delta t is large enough, then you don't care too much about the asymptotic properties. And so then you end up with something where like a high order, but not the highest order ends up being good. And you can, when you see that in practice, you know, you then start to have to see like, oh, here's how what I've proved heuristically applies, but here's how we should be looking at what we should be proving differently, which brings you down, you know, into looking at different things in the math, which then brings you down to the different problems of computing, and you kind of work this back and forth. It's a lovely world.
Absolutely. And that was yet again a really great description of the sort of advances and how intrinsically maths and computing are linked together and all. And by the time you were sort of completing your undergraduate degree, two really pivotal things happened. And were they influential in sort of making you foray in this direction of actively researching at the interface of maths and computing? One was obviously the ImageNet revolution that sort of really kicked off the deep learning revolution that began and all. And there was also the formal sort of formation of the Julia programming language, and something that you have been very intimately associated with its phenomenal development over the last decade. And so how important were those two events in sort of helping you be where you are currently?
Yeah, so I'll actually have to correct you there. I was not with Julie at the early stages, right? I didn't get into Julie until about 2016, so about, you know, like four years in. But that's like a whole story. But I'll get there. My foray into leaving undergrad is actually quite interesting. So I did a research experience for undergraduates. You know, this is an NSF run program. I did a summer in Baltimore with UMBC, so University of Maryland, Baltimore County, on high performance computing. It was basically like, how do you do things like MPI and parallel programming? And with that, I went actually down more of a statistics route, because I was more on like the mathematical group instead of like the computer science group. And so I built a bunch of GUIs in R, but you know, that's where I really learned like, you know, compute performance. Like because I chose to do R. I chose to build, you know, interfaces and graphical user interfaces in R before anything like Shiny was a thing, right? So it's like kind of building these things from scratch, while in a program that was about learning about high performance computing. And so then I started really digging down, like, okay, how do I make this fast? And like, you know, playing around with all that. And so yeah, that was my foray into like a real compute project. But because of all of the, you know, weird compute details and everything around, I actually got far enough, you know, and we built this interface for the Department of Natural Resources in Maryland about to monitor the Chesapeake Bay and all that. And you know, that project actually turned out very well. We got an undergrad paper out of it. But I was after that, I was kind of like, you know, I don't know if I really want to do too much computing things, right? And so that's why I kind of for a lot of what I was doing for my grad applications, I went to be like, okay, let's apply to something that's a lot more mathy, like, you know, stochastic analysis and such. It was kind of funny because like from that RU, I could tell like, you know, like programming and mixing the math with the programming was like definitely where my real skill was at. But I think it's an undergrad thing to want to like do something else for a little bit, right? And I see that all the time with undergrads I work with. So you know, they come in, they're like, I don't know if I want to do X. I'm like, all right, we'll see in 2 years. But yeah, so I went away from doing programming and all the coursework that I did, though I did come back to it. I got a job on campus. That was to help build a simulation platform that's kind of like Stella. There's this one called Nova Modeler. So if you actually look for it, you'll see that like a lot of the old tutorials for how do you do the write the modeling scripts in JavaScript, where you know I wrote those tutorials and I put my name on them and everything. So yeah, that was like 2012 or something. Like everyone knew that I was going to go to differential equation solver libraries except for me. And so then in the summer though, I was like, okay, you know, I want to, you know, I've been, my whole undergrad was about the theory of modeling and all this. And so I want to look at like modeling without models, which is machine learning. And so I went to RIPS Hong Kong. So it was this program put on by IPAM in UCLA, where they bring a bunch of students to Hong Kong over the summer as a research opportunity. So I worked with Baidu wrote a bunch of machine learning pipelines. But then, yeah, what I really learned from all that was like, man, I really don't like machine learning because there's no mechanistic model. It doesn't explain to you the science behind why it's doing these predictions, right? So you know, in my publication history, you'll see that I kind of brought that up to a preprint and everything, and then it was just like, no more machine learning. So yeah, that was, you know, so I wrote this entire Python pipeline where I learned, you know, all these machine learning background methods and everything, and then just kind of stuffed it in away for a bit to go back to mechanistic modeling and differential equations. And you know, that's when I've really found my stride. And yeah, and then it wasn't until about 2019 or 2018 that I started looking at it and going, wait, those don't have to be two different worlds, right? Like, you know, I put them as two different worlds because I did them in different projects and everything. But, you know, mechanistic modeling and machine learning can actually act together, right? And the way that I really started seeing this is that I was spending so much of my time trying to build a model. And so the discussion was like, you know, everything good comes out of being lazy, right? And so like the real question was just like, is there a way such that I can have the computer tell me what I did wrong in my model, right? Could I have my computer tell me like, oh, you missed a minus X here, right? And the answer really started to be, oh, what happens if you embed neural networks and within differential equations and train these as part of your problem and then be able to use symbolic regression to tell you, you know, what are these things that could be missing in your model? And that brought me down this whole route of, you know, doing the stuff in neural ODEs and universal differential equations. And that really then became SciML, the organization which started as being these differential equation solvers that then became these differential equation solvers that mixed in machine learning, right? The route of SciML was really the route of my research, just kind of moving through from mechanistic modeling to then bringing back that world of machine learning and really seeing how it fit into like a scientific workflow. So I think that, you know, that nicely then ties in like, okay, well, when did all the Julia packages and everything start, right? When I was doing my PhD, I started my PhD by getting into this problem about how can you control the randomness within a biological organism, right? I went there to UC Irvine to work on stochastic differential equations, you know, which are these differential equations that have randomness associated with it. It's basically Brownian motion as part of the differential equation. What we found really early on, right, was, at this, so part, you know, because I like this connection to real science, right? I actually was doing lab rotations in a zebrafish lab. So you know, like when you think of a mathematician, you probably don't think about them like, you know, pipetting things into tubes with zebrafish embryos. But that was my my math training, right? So what we found with all that though, you know, so what so if you take the zebrafish embryo and you do this new form of microscopy that they worked on this lab here, which is called fluorescence light induced microscopy, so FLIM, what happens is you can very accurately measure this retinoic acid gradient. So it's this gradient that tells you, it's the same gradient actually that tells you how far away your fingertips are going to be from your arm, right? But this is actually going down the hindbrain of the zebrafish during its development. And what we saw was actually really cool, right? It was if you take the wild type embryo, right, and then you inject something that would block this protein, which is CRABP, you would not change the positioning or the amount of retinoic acid, you know, where this gradient is, right? It's on you wouldn't change any of that, but you change the amount of randomness, right? Which is perfect because I wanted to work on stochastic differential equations, right? So if you inject something to block this, you increase randomness. If you inject more of the CRABP, you will decrease the amount of randomness in this gradient that is telling the zebrafish the information about how big its hindbrain is. So what is the mathematical process that would be able to tell you how to control randomness within a biological organism, right? That was like the core problem that I was working on. It was like, you know, how do you put together biological signals such that you have a distortion pedal in there, and then you can tweak the knob higher or lower at will, right? So I put together a model and I worked on this mathematical analysis for a while. And I found out like, hey, you know, if you build a biological protein network like this, then you will certainly have that property, right? That there is something that will be able to change the amount of randomness without changing the mean values of these concentrations and all that. And so then I went to you know, I proved this theorem on it. And then I did the non-spatial version of the model, everything worked out. And then I created a spatial version of the model, right? So, you know, it's like, oh, here's the hindbrain over space and everything's diffusing and here's all the randomness. And it was like, this should, you know, this simulation should show us exactly how this whole thing evolves and how you have a natural noise, attenuating device in here, right? And it was taking a while to solve. And so then I looked at I put a progress meter in there and it told me that it would take 3.8 years for the simulation to finish. And so I was like, all right, you know what? Yeah, this is where I'll start to change the move to methods, right? Because, you know, if I can solve this problem, then I've solved a really cool problem. But, you know, this MATLAB code is gonna take 3.8 years to finish simulating. So let's go on to methods, right? So then the question I started asking was, for these stochastic differential equations, why can I not just call ODE 4.5 for stochastic differential equations, right? Now, if you had an ODE, you'd call ODE 4.5, you call ODE 1.5S, and you know your problem is done. It's pretty well optimized, and you know I learned that it's not actually that optimized pretty later, but but you know it seemed like, you know, like why doesn't MATLAB just give you an adaptive high order integrator for stochastic differential equations that just does this fast, right? So that became then this research thread that I would go down, right? So all this stuff on zebrafish, developmental biology, et cetera, was like, you know, this is the crown jewel that will happen if I can make differential equation solvers for stochastic differential equations fast, right? So then I worked on a method, which is, this is rejection sampling with memory. It's one of these nice papers then that kind of describes how you would do adaptivity of stochastic differential equations with higher order integrators. Where do you get the error, et cetera, like, you know, details. Wrote this paper, submitted it, and then the reviews came back saying like, we want you to show that this actually does something well on a very big example, right? And so I was like, all right, like, you know, if you want me to show this on a real-ish kind of hard problem, then I need to really turn it into like, you know, my example test code of like, you know, a few hundred lines of MATLAB code is not enough, right? I need to actually write the ODE 4.5 of stochastic differential equations in order to make this reviewer happy, right? And so then I was sitting in the back of a workshop. So I was teaching people in a MATLAB workshop, actually teaching people how to do things for dynamical systems. And, you know, just kind of playing with the, you know, the challenge was then to kind of create the fastest code, right? And I just read on like Hacker News or something about, oh, there's this Julia language. So I took my MATLAB code, I turned it into Julia code. I got about 100 times faster. So I was like, I win the challenge, right? So at that time, so that all happened in like the same week. So then I was just like, wait a second. If I'm going to actually create like a real package for solving stochastic differential equations, let me do this in Julia and show how fast I can do this. Right. So that way I can show the reviewer, like, you know, like, hey, look, we can do this thing like 10,000 times faster than something naive in MATLAB. Right. So that's what it does. And so that was when differentialequations.jl started. If you go to the very earliest versions of differentialequations.jl, you'll see, like, you know, if you go to the earliest tag of version tag, you'll see in the README that it says, this package is for, you know, differential equations research, like stochastic differential equations. If you're looking for ODEs, look elsewhere, because we're not going to work on ODEs. which is kind of funny, because now it's known as like the ODE solver of Julia, right? But in the first stage, it was really for this research project. And so then I started working on it. I got like this full working version and everything. But then the question was like, wait, how do I know if my stochastic differential equation solvers are well optimized? It was like, well, I can go back to ODE solvers and then check those against the C and Fortran versions. And whatever I have to do in order to optimize the ODE solvers, I can use those optimization tricks in the SD solvers, right? So that's what it came down to, right? A lot of time then in building high performance ODE solvers, specifically then to be able to take those tricks over to the SD solvers. And then that was during that summer of 2016 or so. You know, that's when I started digging into all these details, writing a lot of blog posts on Julia. And then what really happened during that was, you know, after digging into the performance details, I found out like, wait, you know, why are they using this ODE method, right? If you really want to do things fast, then here's a method that, you know, ODE 4.5 should not be using the Dorman-Prince method anymore. It should be using the Sidiris method because it'd be more stable. And, you know, so like, you know, I was trying to really hyper-optimize everything. But then what I found out in the end was that we were able to beat the Fortran codes, right? We were able to actually outperform them in the C or Fortran codes. And so then once we put out the blog post really showing like, hey, you know, this thing got really optimized. Like the point was to optimize it for the SD solvers, but because of just like sitting down there and like trying to use every single trick in the book that, you know, that has, you know, like the ODE solvers from before were written in like 1980, right? And so then like the post is basically like, here's everything that happened since 1980 that we're able to then shove into this ODE solver to really give you that next, you know, 5x of performance over like the C and Fortran codes. And once that blog post went out, you know, it really took off from there. You know, everyone was just started being interested, and there was just all these feature requests like, oh, what about making it so that way it works with GPUs and et cetera, et cetera. And then it really became this question of how do you make an ODE solver not lose performance when you can kind of make it cover this whole world of things, right? And how does this world of different problems that you solve, how do they all interact? At what point do you call it a different algorithm? And, you know, and so that's when, you know, very quickly, I went from just being someone who only worked on ODEs to being the someone, I think I hold the record now as the person who's done the most commits and maintains the most packages in the Julia programming language, right? And it all just became around this whole goal of, well, how do I do these kinds of modeling problems fast? And now to end that story, that problem that took 3.8 years in MATLAB, we now keep it as a benchmark inside of the SciML benchmarks. It takes about 30 to 60 seconds to solve it within the modern stochastic differential equation solvers. So that tells you that that whole journey then came back to, you know, that paper that started my PhD did not get published until the fourth year of my PhD, but it was a very good challenge problem to then drive all the other research around it.
That was absolutely phenomenal story of the fantastic work that you did sort of during your PhD days and all, and right at sort of creating, pioneering new methods and all. That was really inspirational and fantastic to listen to and all. And something that I'm interested in asking, as someone who did so many things and who sort of had their own fair share of rejections that sort of inspired a lot of these things and all. So how did you confront, and how do you even nowadays do you confront rejections in academia and science in general? Because rejections in academia are pretty common. There is always the reviewer too out there rejecting your code, rejecting your papers and all. And there are multiple other rejections one faces and all. And how did you also confront the exhaustive environment that many of grad schools are? And did you have to confront the ubiquitous imposter syndrome too at any point of time?
Yeah. Oh, great. Yes, great questions. You asked the right questions. I wish a lot of students would ask those questions. So I think, rejections happen all the time, right? The way that I always deal with it is, when I get an email that says this paper was rejected, right? The first thing I do is I snooze it for 2 weeks, right? It's like, not even going to go into the details now, right? It actually takes me longer to answer rejections than it probably should. But I think that, really taking the time to process it well is the key, right? But what I really try to figure out is like, I think that a lot of people kind of think that the world is, a lot of people are technical, so they want the world to be technical, right? But I think that a lot of real problems are, mixing a technical with a social one. There's always a social problem involved in everything, right? So when I get back to it, right, in the right mindset, right, I really like to dig into it and just think, why is this person interested in that question, right? How could one reviewer like it and then one reviewer hate something, right? It means that they're coming in with a different mindset, right? And so it's really a question of what is their mindset and why, and what is the thing that should be done to someone with this mindset, right? So like the thing with the stochastic differential equation paper, right? It was really this person seemed to be someone who really thought that, if you want to show that a numerical method is useful, you need to show it in reality, right? What would be the mindset that would get that person to finally accept the paper? Well, it's to make it a real software package, right? The actual details that they asked for in the review, show that you can make it on like a harder problem or anything. I think that had nothing to do, those are the things that they can think of on the top of their head, but that's not their actual mindset, right? Their actual mindset was, if I saw this as a package that I can use myself and I can see that it was fast, then I would believe you, right? Like everything about the math is fine, but they wanted that last belief step. And so when I realized that, that's when I was like, my advisor was like, writing open source software and everything is how people kill their careers. So don't do it. He was actually never a believer in any of this, but it was just kind of funny, right? Because he's my one co-author on the differential equations, that JL paper for the Julia differential equation solvers. And he was always like, you really shouldn't be working on this. And he's right that in general, a good way to kill a good PhD career is to start working on open source software. But I just kind of looked at this and was like, I think that the right way to solve this problem is to make this thing. And I would like to use it too, right? That mindset that person had was my own mindset, right? Yeah, like it was just like, well, would it actually be useful to solve this 3.8 year simulation? Like, I don't know. But the paper that I had written, I still didn't know if it was useful for that problem. And so it was like, okay, he's asking the right question. I should have answered that question. And you know what? The way to make him happy is to answer that question for myself, right? And so that's when the whole journey went through. And when I can finally answer, write down the question and be like, yeah, here's the software package. We use it on this big real problem. You can download it yourself too and see exactly how well it works. That's when it was like, okay, that's the answer. And it was accepted without an issue. So I think that happens all the time, with grant applications and old grad school applications and everything. Like, you really just kind of want to figure out like, why is this person thinking like that? And what should I be changing to be able to match, like, not just the technical aspects, but like also the social aspects around it, all these questions of like, did it get the right, did it look prestigious enough is something where it's like, you can put little technical points there, but the look of it, also just like includes, you know, that are enough people using it that and are enough people, you know, tweeting about it, just saying like, oh, this actually made my problem faster, right? You know, when people see that atmosphere, that's when they will know things about this, you know. And so yeah, so I always like to look at the review and kind of just figure out like what are they really trying to ask. And yeah, I actually wrote a blog post about how you should write applications that kind of driven off of that idea. I send it out to all my GSOC students because they're just like, oh, how do I write a GSOC paper? Or how do I write my GSOC or my grad applications and everything? And so I wrote, you know, I wrote down this blog post that's kind of like, look, think about the people who are actually going to be reviewing things. They're actually also people, right? So keep that in mind, right? They are looking at this from their viewpoint. They have the things that they want to do. And you should be understanding that. So for grad school applications, right? You're not just applying to, you know, you're not just putting an application out there and people reading it don't know you and don't care, right? With a grad school application, the people who are reading that to kind of be like, do I want this person to be my student for 5 years, right? Like, so they're not reading it from like, they're kind of reading it from almost a selfish standpoint, right? And so you want, you know, if you want to make that person happy, you want to make sure that you get into their mindset and be like, what do they want to hear from me? And what should I be doing differently to make them understand that I would be someone that would be able to produce for them for 5 years, right? You know, and when you that might actually change some of the things that you start working on, to change the style of your writing and all that sort of stuff. So yeah. But yeah, there's always more that you can do on that. I think that I'm still very early in the journey. So I might give you a completely different answer 10 years from now.
Absolutely. But that was some really prescient advice out there and all. And you talked about how exactly one sort of like can improvise themselves on basis of the feedback that one receives and all. And rather than just sort of like, you made some really prescient points out there and all. And something that I'm inclined to ask you as someone who pivoted to sort of trying to answer the fundamental questions very early on and all. How many times, or what is the percentage of time do you successfully obtain a result of a problem that you're trying to solve in whatever manner you can define successful, whether it is sort of building some solver or sort of trying to answer a certain question? What is the percentage of time you're typically successful? And basically, how do you prevent your frustration from not making headways towards not absolutely shackling your progress?
Yeah, I'll tell you that 100% of the things that I do are successful because the story is a farce, right? But the story's written later, you know, like I think that a lot of it is like, you know, I had no idea whether, you know, I had no idea what would work a lot of the time, you know. And so when I mentioned like, you know, this whole story of that thing that happened, the stochastic differential equation solvers, right? There was a lot of dead ends, right? But it was really just like, well, even just, you know, switching from MATLAB to Julia is one way to speed things up. Even doing this, you know, there's all these like little things. It's just like anything that would speed it up would be part of it, right? But the thing that worked the most is what the story is written about, right? And so that, you know, so there's a lot of, I mean, you can see it in the SciML package ecosystem that there's a lot of like little, like some of them are dead ends. You know, there's also like a lot of little things. It's like, oh, that thing only sped things up by 20-25%. And so, you know, it's just like, is that a unsuccessful research project? No, because it's just never going to be, there's never going to be a paper on it. Maybe there'll be a blog post on it, right? And like, you know, that's just like, oh, you know, here's this, but then, you know, I never really think that any of these things are unsuccessful too, because if you ever create it as like an open source package and it has CI tests and everything, a lot of these things come back as, you know, like something that you kind of just did for fun or you thought didn't do anything will come back to be a very big useful project, right? So actually the synthesis of what created SciML is exactly like that, right? So we were working with, for example, David Duvenon and his student, Jesse Betancourt on, you know, getting implementations of these neural ODEs on very early. The reason why we had the adjoint methods for neural ODEs, right? Adjoint methods came way before they were in machine learning. They we had those implemented in the Julia differential equation solvers for their use case in pharmacology, right? So we implemented them for pharmacology. We thought they were too slow. And the reason why they were slow is because you need to have large enough equations. At this point in time, we understand that adjoint methods are only more efficient when you have 100 ODEs or more. The pharmacology problems we're looking at were about 20 ODE problems. So yeah, we did this whole implementation. We're like, oh, that's not useful. But then it turns out that the adjoint methods are exactly what you need to be able to train a neural ODE. So you put that all together, and you'll see that, I have an acknowledgement in that paper that we're talking to them about this at that time. We put together this DiffyQ Flux blog post that showed you can mix neural ODE, neural networks into ODE solvers, SDE solvers, delayed differential equation solvers, right? And that all that stuff came together those differentiability aspects were written for pharmacology, even though, most of them were not actually used in the pharmacology projects, right? And so there you go. Like the huge major blog post was that kind of got most of the press that the SciML has ever gotten, right? Like that one got translations into multiple languages and everything, right? And the whole reason why all those tools existed is because they were failed research projects, right? What's actually funny with that too is that I took that and was just like, I don't do machine learning. So, neural ODEs, let's put this to the side. So, it was kind of like, it was this blog post that blew up out of nowhere. And then it kind of, when it faded down, it was like, I don't plan to do anything else with that. It's kind of like a funny happenstance of how it all came together, right? It wasn't until the summer when I started realizing that, the whole thing doesn't need to be an ODE. You could make the whole thing doesn't need to be a neural network, right? You can mix neural networks and small neural networks into larger differential equations and use that in funny ways to be able to solve high dimensional partial differential equations, accelerate climate models. And actually the main thing was to be able to automate the discovery of missing terms in models, which was the solution to a problem that we're talking about Pfizer system pharmacology team at that time. Those failed projects caused this big blog post, which is kind of just like a side project, and that side quest kind of died down after we got our gold and talked to the NPCs, right? But then it all came back and it was just like, oh, wait, but this is actually useful now. And so that then became, the DiffyQ Flux project and, this universal differential equations paper, which really then once we found a real use for these tools in our scientific modeling, then it became the organization changed its name from Julia DiffyQ to SciML. And that really became the scientific machine learning focus. So yeah, that's why I say 100% of projects work out, right? If you have a project that's failed right now, I think that you just haven't found out why it's useful.
Some really stellar advice out there yet again, Anol. And coming to problem solving, Anol, how far do you think we are to sort of formalizing or automating mathematics? There has been quite a lot of activity in that area over the past decade and all. And do you think in the near future, it is sort of tangible enough idea to have sort of AI systems sort of proving mathematical theorems on even newer ones that haven't been proved before?
I mean, I feel like you can train an AI to do a little bit, but I don't think that actually captures the true mathematical process, right? Math is a language. It's like math is, has a music to it, right? There's a song. It's a progressive rock song, it's just continuing through its different motions, and the different people that you bring in have their own ideas, their own style to it, And so then you have the person who just walks in with, playing their electrical violin, right? And they bring it in their own direction, right? It has a flow to it, and the flow is based off of styles. And I feel like if you train a neural network, you might be able to train it to match one person's style and complete the work beyond that they would have done beyond their death or something, right? But I feel like the true beauty of mathematics is all this other random things that people are bringing in, right? So the whole aspect that I've kind of brought into this space of implicit methods and such has been how can you use the features of differential equation solvers and understand properties like stiffness of ODEs and everything, and how can you incorporate that into machine learning frameworks? And you know, why was that what I would bring into this? Well, it's because I was working on stiff ODE solvers. I optimized them. I built them to be able to outperform the C and Fortran codes. And so I really sat down and played with them and really understood how these models work and the way that you make these things work fast, right? And so then when I started bringing this machine learning into this world, right, you know, it was just like, well, you know, here's one aspect of my world. Here's another aspect of my world. What happens if I just create a ham sandwich and slap them together, right? Well, you know, then you have to look at, you know, I understood that, like, oh, you have ill conditioning of Jacobians here, which means that now when you put them together, like, well, how does ill conditioning of Jacobians mix with neural networks and all these things, right? And so, you know, that's where like my own style would then flow into this. And you can see that style come out in the papers I write, you know, and then the real reason to work with collaborators, because you're pulling their style in, you know, working with, you know, I work with a student now who's really into, like, you know, it's pure machine learning. And so, like, you know, you see some papers kind of be like, oh, how are neural ODEs good for working on image processing, right? And then, you know, collaborators in climate science, you know, like, how do you mix neural networks into the parameterizations of these climate models and all that, right? You know, like all these different groups coming together. And I feel like, you know, trying to get that full range of thought, it would be really difficult from a neural network unless you plan to do it like, you know, there are some that trying to do like the StarCraft bots or the chess bots, where, like, you know, you train a whole ensemble of them and they all kind of learn different ways of doing things and then you challenge them against each other, right? I feel like you'd almost have to do that, you know. You'd have to have like a whole world of different AIs, but then have them interact with real mathematicians. And then, you know, then it's really the connections between all of them that would start to do something well. But yeah, I think that when you're in the research environment and in the research process, you know, you'll see that the style element. Everyone always talks about technical things as though like the technical is, you know, everyone wants technical and to be God, right? But in reality, it's always a social, math and science is always a social element to it. And I think that you'd have to really capture that social element well as well.
Truly, that's a really fantastic point and a really terrific soundbite out there about maths being a progressive rock music of sorts. And that was a really fantastic alteration that you made over there and all. So post your PhD, you have been sort of straddling the whole industry, academia, as well as the open source interface, and with quite an elan of sorts and all. So was it something that you sort of planned to do by the time you're coming to the end of your PhD? Or was it yet another random walk that led you to donning all three hats in a very successful manner?
Oh, I mean, like, that is the most random of random ones. So I was writing these differential equation solvers for the Julia programming language, right? And so, you know, from these blog posts and such, the things I was writing about differential equations were showing up at these conferences then that really use differential equations a lot, you know? So things that you'd know about would be like, you know, astrophysics things, but things that you might not know about would be like pharmacology, right? Because all pharmacology is pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic models of internal drug concentrations. And so these need to have very fast differential equation solves at high accuracy. And so it turns out that they were talking a lot about these differential equation solvers I was writing. And so someone wrote an email, you know, so Vijay Ivaturi, this, you know, someone in the School of Pharmacy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, he wrote an email to the CEO of Julia Computing, Viral Shah, saying like, Julia's got the differential equation solver stuff going. Pharmacology is an area that is still using the differential equation solvers from the 70s, right? The current program everyone's using for doing clinical trial analysis, something called NonMEM, which is written in Fortran and has a set of Perl scripts that go with it, right? So it's Fortran and Perl. And it was basically just like, can we revolutionize this space of pharmacology using the stuff in the differential equation solvers of Julia? And, you know, Julia Computing at the time, the founders of the programming language were like, well, we don't do differential equation solvers. So they just straightforwarded the email to me. And so like, I was like, oh, show me everything that they're doing. Right. And so like, he sent me all these things, like, here's exactly how they're doing all these things in pharmacology. Right. And, you know, the thing that I always like the technical aspects, right. And I always like to write about, like, you know, how things should be done when you're trying to solve a certain equation and stuff and why. And so, yeah, I think that we've actually posted this blog post onto the, my email response to Vijay into a blog on the history of pumas, right? So you can find it online. Basically, I wrote to him like a 6-page response of like, oh, no, you shouldn't really not be solving them like this. Like, you know, here's all the things that I would do differently. And so then it was just like, I mean, people do know what they're doing here, right? You do realize that, but I was like, yeah, I'm pretty confident though, right? You probably want to use a higher order method because you know that this thing actually has these smoothness properties. You want to probably use forward mode automatic differentiation instead of this form of sensitivity analysis, because that will let you SIMD across these things, and that will get you another 2x or, you know, like all these little details. And then it was like, well, if you really believe that's going to be true, then this is a multi-million dollar industry that, and so I was like, you know what? I'm already working on optimizing these differential equation solvers for biology. Pharmacology is very similar, right? So I put together a prototype of that for him for University of California, Berkeley, the JuliaCon there, JuliaCon 2017, the first JuliaCon that I went to. So that's when I gave the differential equations at Yale workshop. But then a lot of that was also the, you know, talking with Vijay there and just kind of like being like, hey, look, you know, here's the prototype I've been working on. And look, it does run at the speed that I said it would, right? And then it was just like, wait, this is working. And so one of the first meetings that we ended up having then was with Brian Corrigan, director head of pharmacometrics at Pfizer, right? And then that was a really interesting conversation because I thought it was just going to be like, oh yeah, you know, this is my research. I work on differential equation solvers. You know, would Pfizer want to use this thing? And the response was, well, we'd only want to use it if you can get the FDA validation to be done on it. You have to pay for the FDA validator's time. So you need to do a fundraise of, you know, a few million. And that's when it was just like, what? So yeah, but it's like, oh, if you do a fundraise for a few million, yeah, I mean, like the subscription for, you know, like, you know, we're doing a license for, you know, $20,000 per year per person or something, like, you know, yeah, there could be built business out of this, but it's only useful if there's a business built out of it, which is not what I was expecting at all, right? Like, even Vijay and I thought, you know, like, oh, this would be something open source, right? Very, very soon it started being like, okay, this needs to get, if we want this to actually be used, right? And that's my whole goal, right? You know, trying to find out what is the underlying processes that would be useful for really understanding the world, right? And so this is like, you know, this is my time to finally bring my own, you know, mathematics into like something that's really useful, right? That whole goal started looking like, well, this needs to have like a real entity behind it to make it so that way an actual pharmacology firm can use it, right? And you know, Vijay worked with someone called Joga Gaburu, who was the director head of pharmacometrics at the FDA from 1998 to 2010, I believe. So he knew everybody in the industry because he was the one who wrote all the, you know, he wrote all the regulations and everything, and he appointed everyone to the FDA. So like, you know, even today this year there was a new director head of pharmacometrics. And I was just like, oh, do we know him? And it's like, yeah, that was one of Joga's hires. You know, so you know, it was really with the Vijay and Joga then that I was like, okay, what needs to be done to make Pumas a reality? And you know, sat down and created this full first version of Pumas. And then in 2018, 2019, that's when it was like, okay, this is a real software. Let's get a sales team and start selling it, right? And that's when it really took off. And so that's why I started going to a lot of pharmacology conferences, meeting these people. In fact, one of the things that was, I'll tell the story in the way that I understand it as well, like personally. So, you know, at the 2018 pharmacology conference, right? I put up this poster showing like, oh, here's how we're doing these new pharmacometrics things in Julia. Here's how much faster it is, you know, and there are a few people who came up to the poster and it was like, you know, they'd ask questions and I'd be like, no, let's go back to your computer. I want to see all the equations that you're solving, right? And then it's just being like, oh, I would really try to do this thing differently, like, you know, because I love looking at the details, right? So I did that with a lot of people in 2018, right? In 2019, then we came back around and like, we have a company here, talk to our sales team, you can start to use this, right? And then that's, you know, and then we really optimized and got Pumas as a real software out there. And one of those sales, right? So one the people who I'd, that I really worked with and started talking to, right, in 2018, in 2019, they a lot of those were the same people who kind of did some of the first sales, right? And one of those people was the director head of pharmacometrics at a not very well-known firm called Moderna. And so then when 2020 rolled around, right, it, basically it was just like Pumas was what they were using for a lot of the FDA submissions. And so then they that took off in the way, you know, like I would like to say that I had that planned or something, but nobody had that planned, right? It was basically, you know, just me at a random conference just kind of being like, this is the right way to solve differential equations, let me tell you. And they're just like, all right, we'll listen to you because you seem to be getting some results. And suddenly that's, you know, that's the story of why Pumas, you know, if you go to that front page, why it has a quote from the director head of pharmacology at Moderna that says like Pumas has become our go-to software because of its speed, perform, you know, all this kind of stuff. Like that, that's where that all comes from, you know, just this, this, and so, yeah. So, so Pumas really worked out in the end. I mean, it really just was the, this project of, you know, like if we do these things correctly and really get to the speed and give a nice workflow, then people will be happy. And that turned out to be correct. And then we're, you know, talking with the CEO of Julie Computing, right? Because you know, I've been talking with him a lot through this because he's the one who forwarded me the email in the first place, right? It was just like, what's the next project that you want to be working on? So at that time, I took the position at MIT. And so when the company kind of started up and everything for Pumas, I was like, I'll take the director of scientific research position. So that way I won't need to be doing a lot of the day-to-day engineering anymore, kind of passing it off, but like still doing like the, you know, new methods. Like basically it was like, okay, you know, the Pumas is now starting to sell, it's grown up into its thing. So I took a position as, you know, a director of scientific research within Pumas AI, which is what I hold today, right? So that way it's like, oh, I'm not going to do day-to-day engineering. I will be still, you know, doing as part of my research, trying new methods and adding it into Pumas to be able to accelerate it and such. But, you know, I don't need to run the day-to-day engineering team and the reporting and all that, right? So then I was talking with the CEO of Julie Computing and was like, well, what's the next thing that you want to be working on? And that was right about exactly the time when the DiffyQ Flux neural ODE blog post and everything came around. And I was like, I think the right problem to solve right now is how do you bring machine learning into modeling processes? And what would be, you know, what's the future of things like, you know, Modelica, Simulink and all those in a world where we can automate a lot of that with machine learning, right? And that we got some RPE grants around building a new modeling system that would integrate machine learning in. And then that became into, you know, once we realized that, hey, we can get things like 500 times faster than this commercial software, then it was like, well, there you go. There's the next commercial venture, right? Julia Sim built around, you know, GUIs that would allow you to kind of integrate machine learning and build surrogates of things. And so, yeah, So I think that the point of the story is it truly was a random walk, right? There was no, you know, it was answering a blog post and then defending my honor when I said that this is how fast it would be, right? And at the end of the day, they told us like, oh, you know, it's only going to work if you make it a company. And they were like, you know what? Then if I need to defend my honor here, let's make it a company, you know. and so at the end, and then you know, all this kind of came out of nowhere. But I think that it's been nice because like, you know, some people, you know, my focus over the last 2 years has kind of really been how do you make, you know, these differential equations improvements in pharmacology. And then the side project was, well, let's use scientific machine learning and figure out how this is working because this is fun, right? But then, you know, that then starts to enter the foray as, okay, now that becomes like the next big problem to solve with the company around that. And then, you know, it's like, oh, what's the next small problem to solve? Well, doing some things around modeling languages and symbolics and stuff. And I'm pretty sure like 5 years from now, that'll be like the next thing that will become like into the foray. You could already see it moving because it moved from being like a side project to being like the JuliaCom workshop of 2021, right? So it's like, you know, it's always side projects that become your real projects sooner or later.
Really great overview out there and some really terrific statements and all. And so I'm inclined to ask, so what does the near future and the broader future hold for you as well as Julia and Puma? So where do you see yourself going from here? Your absolutely stellar work in scientific machine learning has driven a lot of pioneering advances and all. And so how do you plan to carry forward in the coming few years and all? And is there any particular problem that you are trying to solve or that you'd like to see solved in your lifetime?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that there's kind of two big threads going on right now, right? One of them is, you know, how can you use machine learning to accelerate models, right? Which, yeah, there's a bunch of surrogates out there and you know, a bunch of people have research on this. The research that we've been trying to do is like, okay, you know, but we can't sit there and tune surrogates for everybody. So how do you make it so that way you can get an architecture that will work on the hard, stiff problems the first time you try it, right? And so that's where this whole continuous time equistate network comes from. And then our for the near future, what you'll be seeing with things like Julia Sim and also Puma's QSP. So for quantitative system pharmacology in this like our area of doing larger pharmacology models, you'll see that the things that are coming out around that are, how do we make it so that way you can build a model and then just click a button and get a surrogate, right? You know, how do you click this, you click the acceleration button and then you get a machine learning acceleration, right? And it's like taking it from the level where someone in a research paper can be like, oh yes, my PhD student sat down on it for 2 years and here you got this 100 times acceleration, right? Like we're taking it from that level to being something that you know is going to work so well that you can sell someone, you know, a tens of thousands of dollars button is a bit of a difficult problem. Right. But I think that that's a near future problem. And we have a lot of prototypes already working. So that's what you'll see as this near future, right? Like I kind of think that, you know, after we do it and put these things out, you'll probably see, you know, other groups start to try to have similar things like that. And that'll be the change of modeling and simulation software in the next, you know, 2 years, right? Just everyone having a surrogate button inside of there, right? What's after that? Well, I think that the real problem that keeps me up at night, right? The one that I find interesting is more so like everyone talks about like this, you know, how do I accelerate simulation with machine learning? Because it's easy to academically study and put a number to, like who can do this with the least data? Who can get the fastest thing in the end? Who can make it work on this problem, right? And so, you know, that one gets a lot of academic writing about it. But the thing that doesn't get at real academic writing, but actually matters in industry is how do you automatically come up with a model, right? And it, you know, it comes all the way back to what I was looking at the beginning, like where does the model come from and why do you know that this model is true, right? How do you come up with a mechanism? And the whole reason for not doing machine learning was because you can have mechanistic models, right? And so you know, really coming back to it and being like, oh, what is the, you know, how do you make machine learning give you a mechanistic model? You know, so we have some things like the universal differential equation paper, which then was brought into the pharmacology space as deep in LME. We'll be giving a award talk at ACOP this year, actually, about how we were using this to do some model discovery for clinical trials of macular degeneration, right? So it is starting to be used, but I think that really making it so that way it's like fully automated is still a bit difficult. Right. And you know, what I really want to happen is, you know, so a scientist can sit down, they build a model, they put in some data, and then, you know, and then it basically says, oh, for no parameters, will this model fit this data? But if you change your model like this, like if you add an X squared term here, then your model can fit the data. The other choice is you add a Y squared term here. Those are your two choices that would be able to fix your model. Right. And then they go in and say, well, an X squared term here would mean that there's lateral friction. A Y squared term here means that there's yaw friction. And so let's like actually look at, you know, some measurements of those two things and see which one is true, right? And then come back to it and say, oh, this is the missing mechanism, right? Like that is the future, I think, right? You know, what people would do right now is you would create a model and then you realize you can't fit the data, you know? And so then you'd be like, all right, let's go back to the literature, right? Like, so, you know, it's really hard to define how much better this makes the real process. But when we work with the quantitative system pharmacology team at Pfizer, right? You know, when we talk to them, it's like, yeah, you know, accelerated simulations is great because it can help us, you know, get our results faster. You know, like, you know, instead of getting our results back a week later, we'll get it back a day later. But the modeling process still will take us, you know, 4 months, 6 months because of how much just random of reading literature we have to do. And then after we try to fit something, you know, then we have to go back and see like, okay, it didn't fit. So we'd have to change our model, right? Making the simulations faster will make that process faster, but it's still extremely manual, right? And so if you actually want to take the time it takes for a clinical trial to, you know, to start and everything from 1 year to, you know, 1 month, the answer isn't to make simulations faster, which is what everyone's working on. The answer is to help out modelers actually figure out what they're missing in their models. That's hard to quantify, and it's hard for anyone to be able to say like, oh, I made it 10 times better, right? You know, but that is the real problem to solve. And so I think that that's the problem, which enough has been published on it academically now from our group that I don't know if there's much more to say academically. Like the rest of it is almost, you know, like, let's just go show it works on real industry problems. And so that's what we're doing, you know, working with pharmacology groups, working in, you know, things like with climate modeling groups and all this, the people who really need to be able to figure out models and need to figure it out fast because they need to solve the real problem, right? That, you know, even if we can't quantify how much better that makes their life, they will feel it. And so they will like it, and they, you know, and that's at least a market, and that's, you know, then when it becomes an industry thing, right? And so that I think will be the real problem driving me for the next, once all this surrogates go from me giving these talks to these groups to, you know, the sales team doing it and everything, once I hand off the whole surrogates thing, that'll be the real problem to solve.
A really lucid overview of the big problems that are out there and that you sort of hope to get a tangible solution to, both in the near as well as long term and all. And in your fantastic journey through science and life, how important have mentors been to you? And who are some influential mentors in your professional and personal life? And what is some piece of advice that you also that you have picked up from them and that you pass on to your own mentees?
Yeah. Oh man. Mentors have always been a big influence. I think that it's mentors that really challenge me that are the ones that have really stuck with me. Right. You know, like there are some that are just like, I'll just be your friend, you know, and like, those are great. Like I'll still talk to them and everything. Right. But there's just always these few moments where it's like, you know, when someone tells you like, you should really try doing this another way, you know, and like, let's challenge, like, you know, let's put a bet on this kind of thing, you know, and that really was kind of almost life-changing in some cases. So, like someone who I would say like was a pretty pivotal mentor for me, who I still haven't talked to in like, you know, maybe like a decade or now or something, but, you know, they still sticks with me is, Dr. Matthias Gobert at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, right? One of these people who ran this REU at UMBC, you know, when I first learned high performance computing and everything. And, you know, I think the thing that he really brought, so the problem was, you know, if you go and look at the project, like it's pretty clear that, you know, I had written most of the paper and most of the code and everything. And so I was just like, I should just publish it myself. Like, why am I putting other names on it? Right. I had this big argument with them, and it was just like, you know, giving other people credit will always work out for you in the long run. Right. And I was just like, are you sure about that? Like, you know, if I'm the only author, people will be able to see this. And he's just like, don't do it. Like try this for a bit. Right. And, I was very mad with that at first, but, then it became my mantra now, like because it worked, right? You know, just like making other people, you know, giving other people, you know, maybe they didn't do very much, but whatever, put their name in there, make them happy, right? It turns out that, you know, and then a few months later, you know, they're giving a talk about your joint work, and they'll say good things about you. And so, you know, it actually works out better for you in any ways, right? Like if you would have left them off the paper, then, you know, then that talk and that new person that you meet, like, would not have ever met you, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the same thing then happens in open source, like, you know, of course, through SciML, like if you actually dig into the details, you'll see that I've written probably more than 95% of the commits or everything. That doesn't matter though. It's a community of about 40 pretty active developers. A lot of them do very nice work. You know, there's a lot of students who really solve some really interesting problems in a lot of these things. And so it's like, you know, just give every, you know, these people, like, you know, Yingbo Ma and, like, you know, Avik Paul and like everyone that I'm working with, they deserve a ton of credit too. I just started making everyone that really had a major influence on any paper, just throw them on there, because, you know, they did something that was useful, and they should be noted for it. And so you'll see that, you know, and I also worked with a lot of bio labs where then that culture was like, you know, like, oh, you know, you put the lab on the paper kind of thing, right? You know, like one person grew the fish and then one person sliced the fish and then one person, you know, flimmed the fish, right? And so it's like, you know, it's everyone, we're all in there, right? And so it's very different from the math culture of like having, you know, one author or two author papers, but, and you'll see that I continue that to this day. And, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe there's a student who didn't do the adequate amount of work or something and they kind of slide on there, but, you know, but then it's like, when they see everything that comes about it, you know, maybe they're the person who ends up being talking to more people at a conference, you know, then they start doing their own work around, like it all always helps out in the end. So, you know, I feel like it's not something to fight about, you know, like just give the authorship, right? So that, like, that was one of those things that kind of really stuck with me, right? And it was just like, you know, one person that I worked with for one summer a decade ago, but it's still a mentor, right? I think that my major mentors though are definitely my PhD advisor, Ching Nia. I mentioned that we disagreed on a lot of things, but that was exactly the right reason to work with him, right? He you know, he was basically like, here's how you make an academic career. You publish these papers to these kinds of journals and you'll do it right. And I was like, I think I want to throw in the open source aspect, right? It's like, it's not going to work unless you do this, and unless you can do something like this, then it would end up working. I'm like, you know what? Let me do that. Let me try to see if I can make you happy while do. And it was really that, you know, I would say like happy antagonism, right? You know, it wasn't like we have a good relationship, but we also don't see eye to eye, right? On a lot of things, right? But that is exactly the kind of you know, relationship that becomes very useful and really challenges you to kind of grow and do things correctly, right? You know, you can surround yourself with people who are telling you that you do the right thing, but that's not going to help. And you know, then when I started working at MIT, Alan Edelman has also been like a very good mentor. Like we definitely work very differently. Like Alan Edelman's style, I love the style, but it's definitely not my style for doing things. And so you know, really just trying to see, but it's also a very successful style. I mean, like he's a professor at MIT, right? And so a lot of what I've been saying is like, oh, what about the way he does things? Should I be incorporating into the way I do things, right? You know, like, because it is very different, but you know, what, you know, why is he successful? Why have I been successful? And what are the things I should learn from him on that, even though we're very different people, right? You kind of thing. Also like Viral Shah, CEO of Julie Computing, very different person from me. Like, yeah, he mentioned a story actually that this last weekend we're at the Formula One race because we started working with the Williams team, right? And he mentioned to me that, you know, like, yeah, you know, that early investors told him like, oh, you need to work with someone who will go to a steak dinner, right? And he's just like, I'm kind of the guy that'll go to the steak dinner, right? Like, you know, I'll sit down with someone and chat with them and everything. And so it's like, you know, very, very different style, but like, you know, but I think that's when things really come together. Like, you know, he's like, oh, this is the way that, you know, that a company should be run. I'm like, oh, but I like kind of doing it with a bit of technical aspect to it. But it's like, you know, what's the way in the middle, right? Because usually when we both get to the middle, that's when we'll both do better kind of thing, right? So yeah, it's been a journey. And yeah, the ones that really stick with me are the ones that, you know, I agree with maybe, you know, 70% of the time, you know, and that 30% is where you learn kind of thing. Yeah.
Yet again, some really great points out there and some really terrific piece of advice that we all can sort of be inspired by. And this has been a really pleasurable conversation with you on your terrific journey through science and life and the pioneering impact that you have had on the scientific machine learning ecosystem over the last few years and over the last decade in general and all. And finally, as a Random Works podcast tradition, which three people would you like to nominate to come divulge their own experience in a random walk?
I think that Stephen Brunton is always someone that I really like to hear from. Stephen Brunton is a great professor at University of Washington, and I'm a fan of all his work, but also he also does a lot of like YouTube teaching and everything, so he has a cool style. Like I want to kind of like learn from myself, so I would like to hear his journey. Because I've seen a lot of his technical things, but I feel like there's just so much cool about him that'd be awesome to see. Let's see. I think that, the people that I'm, maybe it's just because I'm thinking about them right now, but I mean, like Alan Edelman and Viral Shah would definitely be two people who have like a crazy life journey. Like, you know, Viral Shah was he was doing a PhD at University of Santa Barbara, and then he started like the Julia programming language, and then he started working on the social security system for India, right, before he actually went to start Julia Computing. So, you know, like if you want someone who's done a random walk, like I can't even piece together his history sometime. Alan Edelman is also like that, you know, professor of math, but he also started, you know, this StarP, like parallel MATLAB company, and, you know, and then, you know, then became one of the co-founders of the Julia programming language after that. So, you know, these people who have these like wild journeys. Also someone like Stephen Johnson, also at MIT, he's great. Or Yusuf Marzouk. I could send you a whole list. Yeah.
Some terrific nominees out there. And thank you for coming and divulging your experience in such a fantastic Random Walk.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for having me on.